Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there.
In this episode, we're speaking with Jay Choi of Tecton Ventures. Tecton is an international seed venture firm with roots in Silicon Valley. And we were interested in finding out how they keep up with the seed stage ecosystem across so many geographies. As you will see, we also learned that Jay has some serious cooking skills. We hope you enjoy our conversation. Jay, thanks for joining us today. Can you tell us a little bit about Tecton Ventures? And I know you have a role with Partech as well. Just give us a little background on your relationship there.
Sure. I started Tecton about 10 years ago. So my background itself is I've been an early stage investor in Silicon Valley and also an investor in the last 15 plus years. I joined Partech end of 2006. Partech is actually an early stage fund. It's been around for about 40 years. It's a long history. I started it
with origins in Europe.
Yeah. So Partech is essentially one of the larger US European funds. We have offices in San Francisco and Paris, and have expanded it out throughout Europe, offices in Berlin, and it's become much more of a multi-stage fund and multi-geography fund. But I've been one of the partners that run the US and international sort of investing, mostly early stage and seed. Tecton, I started as a side of Partech back in 08, 09. And the reason being was that at the time, my partner, Vincent, who actually started Partech many years ago, he was essentially retiring at the time of Partech around 2008-09 time. Partech was always Series A and B. And during that whole era, for those that know, the whole micro angel investing was just happening and we didn't have a strategy to go after really earlier stage seed. And so I essentially raised my hand. I said, hey, I want to do it. But we didn't have a pocket at the time to do it. So we essentially started it completely separate with a very close affiliation. But Tecton is actually quite unique. It's an evergreen structure. It's our own house capital. But the other real mandate for Tecton was to really go after seed and also international, broader than the US and Europe coverage, in particular Asia. So it's evolved a bit and we continue to do a lot of work between Tecton and Partech. And because of my duality, I actually leverage both the institutional and the small, nimble nature of Evergreen for advantage of working with entrepreneurs as early as possible.
And just to be clear, you have roles in both of them.
Yes, I'm a partner on both essentially, which is quite interesting, unique, and also requires a lot of late nights and time efficiency, making sure that the time management works. But it works in our kind of dysfunctional and unique family that we run. And we sit in the same offices and we have many companies together that have done very well.
What's been the driving force for you behind that global focus that you've had, particularly with Tecton?
Yeah, it's interesting because the way that I would tell you, I'm not going to come to you and say that I'm this thematic investor. Clearly, we're not in many ways. We're very bottoms up. I think the way that I describe our strategy, it's been an evolutionary model and it's been very organic. We frankly started Tecton as an experiment, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And through that fortunate experiment, one of our first investments happened to be in Korea. Mm-hmm. And just to give you my personal background, I actually was born in Korea. I have extended family there. I go to Asia quite often. And even before starting Partech, I spent 6 years going back and forth throughout Asia in a previous fund that did a lot of US-Japan work. So I've lived abroad many years. And I think the thing that happened of how really Tecton and my international activities happened were just because of a problem that we saw. We said, hey, look, we see all these amazing entrepreneurs in US and Europe and other markets that we back. And so there's these other ecosystems, in particular Asia, that are in some ways underrepresented. And we wanted to be a part of that. And myself personally and professionally. And so one of our first investments that we made in the seed 10 years ago was Coupang, which is at the time there was about 300 of these daily commerce, social commerce companies. And little did we know how dominant and how rapidly that would evolve into becoming what it is today, which is really a full stack Amazon model in the region. And we've continued to obviously parlay those learnings and the relationships that we've been able to build in those ecosystems, particularly Korea and Asia abroad. Yeah, in some ways it was very organic. We were in some ways at the right time and we're able to capitalize on the opportunity. And then we've continued to really apply our understanding of the market and try to help when we can. But I think the singular focus is always, regardless of geography, we're just looking for amazing, you know, outlier potential opportunities with just amazing entrepreneurs that can build.
Right.
One of the things that I found really interesting is that you're not just even limited to Asia. You have investments in India and the Middle East and Latin America, et cetera. To supersede an early stage, you need to be very close to the market to know what is happening at the company formation model. So how can you do that remotely and on such a global scale? I always found that interesting about your model. So what have you done that has worked for you?
Yeah, I think, Dennis, we share this as we've been getting to know each other for the, over the years and we've worked together, is that when we started Tecton, and also given the global model of Tecton and Partech, we stayed close to what our DNA is, which is we look for just amazing entrepreneurs taking Silicon Valley discipline, but applying it in other geographies and domains. And although we don't have direct offices today in particular places like China or Korea or Southeast Asia, we know what is considered success. And so we applied that in our relationships and we said, look, how do we go into a market that we are not currently in? And it was just, frankly, just basic things like working closely with notable groups that we trusted, and we developed relationships with other venture funds that we knew and we trusted. And so the model that we take, frankly, is that we have our core homegrown markets that we continue to invest directly, whether that be US or throughout Europe. And we can either lead or participate as part of a syndicate. And then when it comes to markets where we don't have a physical presence, we have developed very long-standing partnerships with other emerging managers in these specific geographies. And what we actually do is we have a separate kind of entity that makes strategic LP investments when they're relevant, even though that's not the requirement. And the main goal is to really build relationships with those managers, to be able to share information, deal flow, anything that could be helpful for those managers and the entrepreneurs that we work with. And over the last 10 years, that network has compounded of probably 30 to 40 different managers around the world.
And how do you leverage that extensive global network?
I think it's a couple of things. I probably have several calls a week, having regular sync ups of what trends are you seeing? What trends are we seeing? What companies are insightful? And providing some best practices and a collaborative sort of environment for that exchange. In some ways, that's very different, I think, how venture is a super competitive industry, obviously, in specific geographies. We're in many ways very complementary to other ecosystems out there, like throughout Asia. And we're probably one of the few people that are either crazy enough to be able to invest so early, particularly at seed stage, in these geographies we're not locally domiciled in. So in some ways, the local groups and entrepreneurs actually invite us because we add a very different dimension. But fundamentally, to answer your question, I think it comes back down to we leverage it because we get access to things that we probably shouldn't get access to.
Definitely. That's a really thoughtful strategy.
It makes sense, right? Because you can't be spread out too thin. And so you need to have kind of this network. What are some of the trends or peculiarities that you may have seen overseas that you don't see here?
This is just my view, and it changes as we continue to see different things percolating in other markets. One of the belief statements that we have is that the world is flatter than you think on a venture scale. Great entrepreneurs are global. It's not just Silicon Valley anymore. There are the opportunities from the US that are copied and adapted. And you've seen that wave, I call it in the first generation, but frankly, it's becoming the opposite. And you think about things from in Asia in particular, things like live streaming and all the social commerce components like the Pinduoduos of the world. And in many ways, those are homegrown sort of activities and innovations. And I think not just in consumer, but you're going to see cross-pollination, whether that be core technology, whether that be innovation on business model. In some cases, we could adapt something that we've seen in one market, but figure out what the formula is for success in another. I think the best entrepreneurs figure that out in real time, and they're always globally minded.
Yeah, historically, we've grown up to think that innovation is happening in the US and a lot of other countries just copy the same models. But now you're beginning to actually see companies like TikTok that pioneer something in China, then bring it here. And you have Chinese saying, hey, we need to protect the IP and it needs to stay here and all that kind of stuff. Are you seeing a lot of that happening in some of the markets that you're investing?
I think that yes and no. As you see connectivity being pretty prolific now, people are much more open. I think the thing that we haven't seen is true core technology innovation, things where it requires hardware, all the vision of AI and data. I think in Asia, you're seeing some of that. But if you look at other markets today, yes, Europe definitely leads in places like AI and SaaS. But I think some of the emerging markets, I think you're still going to see more consumptive adaptations of what you've seen elsewhere, frankly speaking.
Got it.
And how has COVID impacted your thought process around those predictions?
So I think like any other group, earlier this year, we did an inventory analysis. The one fortunate thing that we've done through our collective investing efforts is we're fairly diversified by sector, stage, and geography. And I think the common pattern that we've all seen coming out of COVID or in the second wave is that there are categories that are just, I think I was listening to, it was a Reid Hoffman analogy of the world got hit by an asteroid and certain things are just going to completely accelerate. I think that's what's happening.
Yep.
Things like healthcare, groceries, e-commerce, and you look at markets outside of the US, it's having even more of a prolific enhancement and acceleration. Fintech, you think about not only in a market like even Asia, where you have much more open banking collaboration now and adoption from a top-down government, but also bottoms-up consumption. And so I think pandemic has only accelerated those things.
Right.
But on the downside, I think obviously we're still dealing with a health crisis. And so I think the challenges really are, when does the new normal become truly normal versus a novelty?
Mm-hmm. What is the wackiest investment or company that you have seen?
One example is we have this company in the gaming space. We invested probably about 6-7 years ago, and it's still a mid-stage company. It hasn't broken out, but I mentioned it. The simple tagline is, think of it as like a Peloton for gaming. And so you put on the headset. It's like a circular treadmill with special sensors on with special shoes. And 6-7 years ago, the future of VR was there, but it really hasn't, I would say, accelerated. And that company is called Virtuix. It's a fitness device, but it's a gaming device at the same time. But yeah, that's an example where it may not be like wacky, but it's a little bit futuristic to figure out when does a timing kick in for something like that.
Yeah. How about your personal story? How did you get into venture? Tell us a little bit about.
Sure. How long does this podcast?
Give us the quick version.
I came here to the US when I was about 4. My parents divorced when they were very young. I grew up basically working. I had a single mom. I worked in restaurants. My mom owned restaurants. And I just remember waking up at 4:30 in the morning, bussing tables and going out during the summers and helping, right? Wherever she needed. So I got that early work ethic exposure. And even just the funny thing is, I think I didn't realize this until probably the last several years of how some of that has influenced me indirectly. I owned a paper route delivering newspapers in my neighborhood.
Sure.
And all those experiences as a kid, you just think of it as, oh, it's just extra income. But as you think about, as I growing up, those direct and indirect influences, I think in many ways has shaped who I am and what I do. And even the kinds of entrepreneurs and people that I choose to work with, because in many ways, I look at the founder as the underdog. You don't have a lot of resources. You got to work, you know, your tail off to be relevant. And ultimately, those are the people and the teams I have probably the most empathy for as I've grown up. And then I think even in every sort of stage of life, whether that be growing up as a kid to even college, like even little things like, I'll give a funny story is, I went to USC for college, but at the time, USC wasn't a top sort of university where big investment banks and consulting companies would come to interviews. I actually started, quote unquote, a consulting club because I wanted to get a job in consulting. And so I put out all these flyers, invited all these people to come, and then invited all these recruiting people. And through that sort of problem set that I wanted my own to create an opportunity for myself, was able to work in consulting out of college. And so I take everything as a lesson from what I've learned as an individual and in my professional experiences. And I try to figure out what is authentic to me that works. And I'm still learning, I think, in many ways. I think that's the very unique thing about this job is you're continuously learning about who you are and what you're learning about the business itself and the people that you're working with.
Great.
Definitely. And tell us a little bit about your experience founding On Air Networks. What did that teach you about entrepreneurship?
I can tell you all the things that you shouldn't do.
Right.
So the little background, that was my first official foray into startups. I worked in consulting at a US European consulting firm called PA. And I was looking for startup jobs because that was the mid 90s back then. It was just, the internet was just starting. And teamed up actually with an entrepreneur that was has started one of the largest private internet exchanges out there. And he was starting this kind of, I call it broadcast.com, if you remember, the Mark Cuban.
Oh, sure, Mark Cuban, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
The streaming encoding provider. I was essentially his analyst business plan writer because I wanted to learn from a successful entrepreneur and apprentice under him. Wrote the business plan and over the inception to fundraising to helping figure out the business model. Ultimately, the company didn't work out. Eventually, we raised about $40 million in aggregate and then during the bubble, sold it to another Seattle-based streaming provider called LoudEye, and then saw that thing go up and go IPO at a multi-billion dollar valuation. It just came down. And at the time, I had left after about 2.5-3 years, and the company went out and had a remarkable bust, but eventually sold. But it was a lesson in high growth, but high growth at a cost.
Right.
And coming into venture, realized that you have to take a much more long-term disciplined approach to company building and venture building, essentially. And that's what I learned, I think, from that.
And that's a great lesson to give to your founders, too. And what made you really interested in venture and wanting to make that transition?
I think that was, frankly, I had two other little startups that I was working at after. And I realized that all three of them were, I call it nominal successes through acquisition. The second company we sold to Sybase at the time. And this is when everything bottomed out essentially after the bubble. Mm-hmm. And I think I looked at my career and I said, look, I want to learn what it means to actually build in a normal environment.
Right.
And so I worked at another small firm called Ignite for about 6 years. That fund was actually started by a venture partner out of Excel. And he was a former head of IBM Japan, and he was a US cross-border Asia specialist. And all of the LPs were from Japan, like guys like Docomo and Panasonic. The Asia sort of international markets got ingrained to me at that time. I was in Tokyo going back and forth probably about, I've probably been to Japan about 50 times over the last those 60 years, living there and traveling abroad. And helping US companies navigate the Asian sort of ecosystem, especially in Japan. And that's where I understood how hard and difficult it takes for enterprise technology to adapt on a global basis, essentially. And so that was in many ways my impetus of trying to, again, solve a problem for myself, because I felt I was missing a lot of components of the full life cycle of how do you get a profitable, you know, scalable, sustainable business to bear.
Tell us about a company that we haven't heard about that you're particularly excited about in your portfolio right now.
So one of the companies that is doing some pretty exciting things is called Toss. It's one of the fastest growing financial service providers, essentially digital banks in Korea. The company, just to give you some context, it started off about 6 years ago as a money transfer app. So very equivalent to what you like in Venmo and the Revoluts of the world. It became profitable on that business alone, and they added other financial products. So think of them today now as one of the fastest growing financial super apps in the country. And for those that don't know about Korea, the one thing about Korea is that even though it's a very homogeneous, tight, quantified sort of population of about 60 million people, many people don't realize that it's one of the top two or three financial markets in the world. This company, think of them as they evolve the business to becoming, many people know about successes of Robinhood and Chime. This is going to be almost a conglomerate of all those applications on top of one platform. And so the company just closed about a sub $170-$180 million financing a few months ago and is rapidly ramping up. Those are the companies that we get excited about super early, because we already see the trend happening in markets like US and Europe. And we're trying to find those in some of these more nascent markets. that are rapidly evolving. Hopefully you'll be hearing more about the company in the coming months as you ramp up.
So I'm going to ask a super random question and call you out a little bit on your last tweet where you said, fact, every food establishment is now a modern day cloud kitchen, hashtag adapt or die. Can you elaborate? Can you elaborate? Oh, wow. I did some recon. Yeah. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
You're putting me on the spot. So
I totally am.
This is probably a personal passion and a professional interest. So personally, if you ask me, I'm a wannabe aspiring chef, if you ask my family. Even in my professional life, I think I've backed probably about a half a dozen different food-related businesses. And I've continued to track the innovation of food, whether that be direct-to-consumer, direct-to-business, various marketplace models. And you think about the time, what's going on today, it's extremely unprecedented. I think the one thing that as COVID has done is really allowed a much more advanced understanding, not only the tools to innovate, but I really do believe it's an adapt or die mentality for whether they be small business restaurant proprietors to their franchises. I think that technology has to be at the forefront of their business. They can't think of themselves just as a food business. And you think about the cloud kitchen concept is just scratching the surface because every major small business, you think about the revenues and the impact it's had because of COVID, and the ones that have truly adapted their businesses are usually the ones that really have adopted technology at the forefront. And I think that trend is not going to be a trend. I think it's just going to be a lasting sort of behavior. And even as a consumer, there are more efficiencies to bear because smaller SMEs are more willing to adopt the practices and the processes into place.
Right.
It's great for the overall society just to have more ability to have choice and efficiency. That's the origin behind it. But outside of that, my personal interests are always looking for the next great food business to either to riff on or to reinvent the menu for.
Love it. And going down the rabbit hole a little bit further and then I'll stop. But what's your favorite dish to make?
I think creature of habit. This is a bad word in my ethnic race, but I like a lot of fusion stuff. Mm-hmm. And my grandparents grew up in Japan, I'm Korean. I have lots of friends that are Asian, but I don't mind having a classic burger and hot dog. So I think the thing that I try to do is take something from the raw ingredients and just riff on it by adding something just a little bit different with an ethnic flair to it. And you may think this is something weird. I know, Thanasis, you're Greek, but I could take a lamb kebab and maybe add kimchi salsa on it and turn it into a fusion kebab. But just to give you some context, that's why I like so much.
Awesome.
Now you have to invite us to your next.
When we're back in real life, we'll definitely go to a lunch or I'll make you something.
So we have four standard questions that we ask all of our guests to get to know them a little bit better and more personally. We're really excited to hear your answers. And so to kick it off, if you could have a magic wand and change or improve something about the VC industry, what would it be and why?
Yeah, I call it a code of conduct. And I think about how I've grown up in venture. I look at a couple of things. I do firmly believe that venture is still a very apprenticeship driven business. I grew up with a very successful mentor that brought me in and essentially has mentored me for the last 15 years. And I've taken the lessons that he's applied, and then uniquely built my own style and craft. So if I go back to what I would change is I think in many ways, I think about code of conduct and mentorship. I think that we're not doing enough as an industry to support the next generation. Whether that be just simple things like even succession issues for partnerships. I know there's a lot of tools and blogs out there that tell people about what they do. And think of me, I'm so great at how I invest in this company. But in many ways, I think about as a practitioner in the industry of what can we do to pay it forward to the next generation of professionals. And I know it's done in a pretty individualized way, the mentorship aspect, but I keep going back to this code of conduct because I think the one thing about what I don't like about it is there's an air of exclusivity to venture. It's extremely hard to get into and to be successful at. And I think the practitioners that are successful, I think in some ways, because of the success, it creates an even higher glass ceiling for others to really reach the next status. And I just hope that if I were to be able to say, hey, what can we do to change that? Let's try to flatten that curve. I mean, you see all the diversity things around gender and race, and it's an amazing way to build that future generation. But I think it requires everyone's part to really think in that mindset and even just have a conduct that allows us to not say, hey, look, I'm not better than the other person or the other professional. Right. That's something that I'm always mindful of.
Right. It's so true. And it's really important. And so for number two, if you weren't a VC and money wasn't a concern, what career would you have?
Ooh, I think I answered that with your tweet question.
Yeah.
But I'll adapt it a little bit. If it probably have to be obviously something in food, but I would say I'd probably want to just travel and be a food travel blogger.
That sounds amazing.
Right. And I'll invite my friends to come and review. Thanasis, you can come with me to Seoul and review the night markets there.
Sold. And I should introduce you to my friend Scott, who wants to do the same thing.
Have your own show on the Food Network.
Exactly. Exactly. So if my next career may actually be that, I'm so lucky.
Love it. You should definitely do it. And who is someone that you look up to and why?
Yes. So I look at a couple of different examples. I look at the traits of what I've learned, I think. Interesting backdrop. So Tekton, Thanasis, I don't know if I even mentioned to you, Jennifer, in Greek, Tekton means builder and carpenter. And the reason why I came up with this is I grew up in a Christian upbringing, and my ultimate example for me is Jesus, right? And he was a carpenter by training. He was a tradesman. And in many ways, the inspiration for us backing what I call global builders and carpenters. And that's one of the examples that I bring up in my sort of, I would say, inspiration and thinking about my background, I grew up. And then I think about another more biblical example too. Like I think about the whole David and Goliath story, the underdog, right? And I ultimately think what I do today, an example, is that David is that ultimate underdog, and the entrepreneur is that ultimate underdog. And I like that. I think I've grown up as in my own personal challenges and adversities that I like the adversity and what it teaches you. And I think it's not just being successful in the worldly sense, but also being successful as a human and as a person. And I think that's something that I think about in terms of what keeps me motivated and waking up at night.
Yeah, you can learn as much from your failures as you can from your successes, arguably more.
So. Yes. Yes, exactly. Definitely.
And so lastly, what's the best piece of advice that you've ever received?
Let's see. I think over the years, I think the simple way to describe it is I think I've learned to be more authentic. I think, and that's one of the pieces of advice that I've continued to fine tune is understanding what my strengths are and really knowing the limits. And I think that's where you think about how do you continue to foster your strengths and be okay with not knowing everything and hopefully surround yourself with other smarter, more capable people. That's one sort of piece of advice that I would try to adapt and apply in what I do. But it's also the things that I think has guided me is that the classic things like identify something that exists, either personally, a problem that exists, and try to solve that problem for the right reasons. Because that's when you know that you're in the right, I would say, sweet spot of focus for yourself. And then I think that a couple other key things would just be to, more from a personal standpoint, I get this for myself with being married and with kids too, is that I tend to talk too much. And I think it's better to listen more and be slower to speak in many ways.
That's a good one. Yep.
I've learned that personally and professionally in many ways that has helped. And just to being a better listener allows me to be a better communicator. But yeah, those are a couple of things that, and I'm constantly learning all the time of what to apply, whether it be my entrepreneurs or family or friends, basically.
Absolutely. And is there any advice that you would give outside of that to founders that are thinking about starting a company, particularly right now in this environment?
Yeah, I think really focus on something that you're going to be passionate about. What is your North Star? And find that personal alignment. And ultimately, I think about my years of being an entrepreneur and being in the trenches. And I think you have to be obviously passionate and capable, but you have to be a little extreme. And there's got to be other energies and motivations besides the fact that you see a big market. And so I think many times, if you look at how we look at entrepreneurs, because we're investing so early, the thing that we always try to understand is the founder's journey. And really, what is it in that person and that team and what they've gone through in their life that has allowed them to project down the road of when the going gets tough, what are they going to do? And right. how are they going to get out of that? And that's the algorithm that we ultimately try to advise the entrepreneurs when we meet them and how we support them during the whole journey.
Right. So. No, that's great. And that goes back to your point about the importance of authenticity and being genuine and self-aware of your own motivations and passions is just so important. So thank you so much for sharing your perspective on all those questions. We appreciate it. And it was great to learn that.
No, my pleasure.
And thank you for joining us today, Jay. Really appreciate you and learned a lot about you today.
Thanks, guys.
And follow us on Twitter @ProofVC or on our website @proof.vc.